Okay, please be seated, everyone. We'll call our next case, which is case number 58913, Christian Lobato versus State of Nevada. I'll ask each counsel to introduce themselves when they come up and present. So is the appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, counsel, if you come forward, and please introduce yourself and let me know if you'd like to have any time for rebuttal as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is J.B. Afo-Manin. I represent Ms. Christian Blaze Lobato. I'm joined by co-counsel Fung Jefferson. I will be presenting the entire argument today, Your Honor. I would ask to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. We will do so. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. If it may please the court, counsel. This is a proper person appeal from a district court order denying a post-conviction petition for a writ of habeas corpus. The three issues that are in front of the court this morning are, one, whether the district court should have admitted and considered Lobato's proffered evidence of actual innocence, two, whether the district court erred in denying Lobato's Brady claims without an evidentiary hearing, and three, whether the district court erred in denying Lobato's ineffective assistance of counsel claims without an evidentiary hearing. I'll proceed with point number one. The first question before this court is whether the district court should have admitted and considered Ms. Lobato's proffered evidence of actual innocence. Ground 23 in Ms. Lobato's original and timely habeas petition includes unrebutted new evidence not presented to her jury proving her actual and factual innocence by more than 24 expert, alibi, and fact witnesses. Ms. Lobato is entitled to collateral review of her new evidence under this court's nearly half-century-old precedent in state ex rel, Orzban v. Fogliani, 82 Nevada 300, 417, P2D 148, 1966. This court ruled a single item of new evidence proving Orzban did not commit this convicted crime warranted the extraordinary remedy of habeas relief and his release from custody. The district court, we believe, prejudicially erred, summarily denying ground 23 by disregarding it was a timely post-conviction habeas petition, and inexplicably treated it as a procedurally barred, untimely post-verdict motion for a new trial. The court relied on Orzban to rule in Snow v. State, 105 Nevada 521, 523, 779 P2D 9697, 1989, that new evidence can be collaterally reviewed in a habeas corpus petition after the filing deadline for direct review of a new motion has passed. Snow was on death row, but this court applied Snow's holding to a non-death row prisoner in D'Agostino versus State, 112 Nevada, 417, 421, 915, P2D, 264, 1996. Orzban is consistent with other states' rulings as well. Most recently, a 2014 case, People v. Hamilton, 115-80, 3D-12, 979, NYS-2D-97, 2014, held an actual innocence claim based on new evidence can be filed under New York's post-conviction statute. Why? Because an innocent person's conviction and imprisonment violates their constitutional rights to due process and prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment, which Ms. Lobato asserts in her opening brief. Ms. Lobato's compelling, once again, unrebutted new evidence disregarded by the district court includes the following: new forensic evidence proving it is impossible she committed Duran Bailey's homicide because he died in Las Vegas after 8 p.m. The time of death is crucial in this case. On July 8, 2001, a time when the state conceded at trial during closing arguments, that Ms. Lovato was 3 hours away in the town of Panaca, a town that has been verified to be approximately 165 miles from Las Vegas. And it was also stated in trial by state's witness that the time it would take to travel at a normal rate of speed would be approximately 3 hours. If you're going excessively fast, possibly 2 hours. New evidence by 9 alibi witnesses and a psychological expert that Ms. Lovato's police statement described attempted rape at an East Side Budget Suites hotel weeks before Bailey's homicide on the other side of town. I should state that was approximately 6 weeks before the alleged murder. The alleged murder, the murder took place on July 1st, 2008. The statement, we say the statement that Ms. Lovato gave to the police officers was a description of an incident that took place in May of that same year, 2001. And that was approximately 6 weeks prior to the murder of Mr. Bailey. New forensic evidence, the shoe prints of Bailey's assailant imprinted in blood don't match Ms. Lovato. New forensic evidence, Bailey's groin was not skinned by Ms. Lovato's pocket knife, and by a person with special skills she didn't have. New forensic evidence, Bailey was alive when his rectum was injured, proving Ms. Lovato was convicted of a non-existent violation of NRS 201.450, which is count 2, which obviously states that a person to be sexually assaulted has to be dead at the time for that crime to be committed. We argue that he was actually alive, and we have new evidence that proves that fact as well. And new evidence implicating Diane Parker's Latino friends in Bailey's homicide should have been further investigated, of which they were not done at the time of interaction. And much more new evidence, all which is unrebutted, once again, by the state. George Shiro's expert forensic evidence, science evidence, is new that Bailey's assailant made the shoe prints imprinted in blood. At the time of trial, there's only testimony that the shoe prints didn't match the size or tread of Ms. Lovato's shoes. Shiro's new evidence undermines the state's closing argument that a random person could have entered the trash enclosure and made the shoe prints prior to Richard Schott calling 911 to report finding Bailey's body. The district court did not find that the affidavits providing evidence for actual innocence, ground 23, are not reliable, trustworthy, or credible, or that the evidence upon which these grounds are based is not reliable, trustworthy, or credible. Ms. Lovato's new evidence supporting her actual innocence is consistent with the state's failure to present any physical, forensic, eyewitness, or confessional evidence at trial linking her or her car to Bailey's homicide, or that she was even in Las Vegas on the day of the crime, on the day of the crime in question. The Metro PD's lab, crime lab's DNA test of Ms. Lovato's car seat cover and driver's side door panel excluded the presence of any blood. It should further be stated, Habeas Exhibit 85 details 40 material differences between Ms. Lovato's statement and the details of Mr. Bailey's homicide. And her statement doesn't include any essential elements of Bailey's homicide. Count 1, when it occurred, where it occurred, or his death from a head injury. Or count 2, when it occurred, where it occurred, or, excuse my language, his anal opening was sexually assaulted. For this court to decide Ms. Lovato's claim on its merits de novo, there are 3 issues of first impression that weren't addressed in Orsborne because the state agreed Orsborne was wrongfully imprisoned. Ms. Lovato argues the proper standard of evidence is, quote unquote, all new reliable evidence that was not presented at trial. The proper standard of proof is clear and convincing evidence that undermines confidence in the correctness of the judgment and if her claim is granted, her charges should be dismissed. Ms. Lobato argues the district court erred, and based on those standards, this court should grant ground 23 and order her immediate release from prison, just as in Osborne, so that justice may finally be served in her case. It should be noted in Osborne that the appellant in that case was released at the close of oral arguments before there was, like I said, time for the justices to deliberate on the actual guilt or innocence. They felt that there was not enough evidence to even hold him in custody beyond the statement of the time period of the oral arguments before this court in question. And the second question before this court is whether the district court erred in denying Ms. Lobato's Brady claims without an evidentiary hearing. The district court erred because Ms. Lobato's Brady grounds 25 and 26 are supported with specific, quote unquote, with specific factual allegations, not belied by the record, that if true, would entitle him or her to relief, quote unquote, as required by this court's ruling in Evans v. State, 117 Nevada 609, 621, 28 P3rd, 498-507, 2001. In the district court, the state didn't deny non-disclosure of the evidence, and the district court didn't cite any legal authority for denying an evidentiary hearing. We submit this court should go beyond granting an evidentiary hearing and reverse Ms. Lobato's conviction on two legal grounds. First, the state confesses error under Polk v. State, 126 Nevada, OP number 19233, P3rd, 357, 360-61, 2010. Failure of the state's answering brief to address a significant issue in habeas petitioner's opening brief is a confession of error by the district court. As well, by failing to address the district court presidentially erred, denying the Brady grounds as procedurally defaulted under NRS 34.810. Procedural default doesn't apply to the Brady claims in Ms. Lobato's original and timely petition under the court's ruling in Mazan v. Warden, 116 Nevada, 4867993 P2D 25, 2000. Parentheses, procedural default only applies to a successive petition where petitioner must establish cause and prejudice for not raising the issue in the first petition. Close parentheses. Second, the state fails to address its district court presidentially erred, arbitrarily denying the due process Brady grounds without conducting Brady's three-part test to determine, one, non-disclosure, two, materiality, and three, prejudice. The district court cited no valid legal basis for denial of the Brady grounds, which the state fails to address, and on that basis, this court should reverse Ms. Lobato's conviction and order a new trial.
Can I have you address something while you still got a few minutes left?
Yes.
On the ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
The claims regarding, I believe they're 38 and 40, the counsel was ineffective for not retaining and calling the forensic pathologist. Can you address that claim for me, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Just one moment. Mm-hmm. Your Honor, it was our argument that the pathologist could have helped to determine the time of death in regards to Mr. Bailey.
I understand all that, but the error that the district court made is your claim is not holding an evidentiary hearing regarding a lot of these ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and that was one of the claims that struck me, and I was looking for your thoughts.
Yes, beyond the details of a why.
Yes.
Okay, because, you know, if I hear your question correctly, it's my understanding that our client, Ms. Lobato, was not given the opportunity to present evidence either there at the trial or new evidence at an evidentiary hearing that would give credence and, how can I say it, understanding to the pathologist's position. We feel that but for her giving that time to state the position of pathologist, we are not allowing all evidence to come into play, and that if we want to allow a person to be convicted without having full disclosure of all possible evidence at hand, where we run the risk of actually putting someone who could be innocent in custody and beyond that found guilty for something they didn't do. We feel that there has to be full explanation and full disclosure of all possible evidence for a client to receive a fair trial.
Thank you.
Counsel, I know we had some questions here, and I know you used the 15 minutes, but I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. You like that? Because you have to take the rebuttal time off the 15 minutes.
Yes.
But we'll give you 2 additional minutes.
Thank you,
in rebuttal, and we'll add 2 minutes to Mr. Owens' time as well. So, Mr. Owens, if you wish to proceed on behalf of the state. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the respondent state of Nevada. Rand Bailey, a homeless, smelly old black man, was brutally slaughtered on July 8, 2001, next to a garbage dumpster on West Flamingo in Las Vegas, Nevada. He suffered multiple stab wounds, his carotid artery and neck had been slashed, multiple blunt force trauma to his head, and significantly, his penis had been severed. That unusual fact was significantly withheld from the media. That was an act of brilliance by the police, an investigative tool. Shortly thereafter, Kirsten Lovato in Panaca, Nevada, started talking about a severed penis, something that no one else was supposed to know about. She says today that she's actually innocent. She was convicted by her own words at the trial. And her own words belie the argument that she's actually innocent. Within 12 days, the police received word that Kirsten Lovato was talking about this severed penis, that she had confided in a high school teacher, adult education teacher, "I did something bad, I need to talk to you." She said she had stabbed a man and cut off his penis and threw it. This had happened on West Flamingo or West Tropicana, and that the victim was old and smelly. That she ran to her car and then showered at a friend's house because she had ick all over her. That she was hiding out in Panaca and that her parents were hiding her vehicle and were going to get it sold or painted after cleaning it because she was afraid someone had seen her distinctive vehicle at the crime scene. She told other friends in Panaca that she had slashed a man's penis in Las Vegas with her butterfly knife and that she was seeing a doctor because her conscience was bothering her. She was suffering from depression and suicide because she was afraid that she had killed the man. When confronted by police, she said, "I didn't think anyone would miss him." She hung her head and cried. She told her parents, "Mom, I did it. Now I have to do what I have to do. I'm sorry, Daddy. Told you I did something awful." In the formal statement to police, she said that she had been out of her mind on drugs, specifically methamphetamine, and had stayed up for 3 days, that everything went black and she didn't remember a lot, but that she was attacked by an older black man who smelled like alcohol and dirty diapers. She'd been sexually victimized before and was upset that nothing was done about it. So this time she took her butterfly knife and cut off his penis. She might have also hit him with a baseball bat that she kept in her car. She drove off and didn't think anybody would miss somebody like that. She got rid of her clothes and the knife. She only remembers bits and pieces and flashes in and out of her memory of this incident. And she said that she could be mistaken about the location and dates. These are not the words of an innocent woman. Certainly, there were a myriad of other facts and inconsistencies and differences, multiple versions of statements from witnesses, things that didn't add up, things that were unexplained. That's why we have jury trials. The jury resolved those facts in the state's favor, and they did it not once but twice. Kirsten Lovato was the beneficiary of 2 juries, both of whom said that she had committed this crime. The jury knew that forensically nothing tied Lovato to the crime scene. In fact, some forensic evidence actually pointed away from her to alternative suspects. They knew that. The jury did not believe that Lovato's confession pertained to some other non-existent incident at the Budget Suites, and no other victim missing a penis has ever been found, let alone a black, old, smelly one next to a garbage dumpster with a missing penis. The jury did not believe Lobato's alibi witnesses. Upwards of 10 to 14 witnesses came in and alibied Kirsten Lobato. The jury could not have convicted her if they believed those alibi witnesses. Now, I can't get inside the jury's head. I didn't listen to the trial. I wasn't there for it. But just reading the cold transcripts, you can see where at least one of these witnesses is openly hostile to the state, changes her testimony every opportunity she can to favor Kirsten Lobato. Other witnesses, we have at least evidence of at least two who were out trying to change other people's testimonies, persuade other people that they were wrong, convincing them that July 8th was the date that they needed to provide the alibi for. Some of these alibi witnesses said she was out ATVing on July 8th. Someone else came in and said, no, ATVing happened after July 13th because she had the scratches. There's all kinds of reasons why the jury may not have believed these alibi witnesses. But in short, they discredited those, and the jury believed that this admission of Kirsten Lobato pertained to the one and only penis sever case I've ever heard of here in Las Vegas. And so they convicted her. It's against...
Let me interrupt you for just a second. Considering the alibi evidence and the import of that, make it more important that there be a forensic pathologist that could narrow the time frame in this particular instance? And this goes to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
I disagree. Opposing counsel says that the time of death was critical. I say no. Dr. Sims gave a broad range of possible time within which this death could have occurred. As I understand their experts today, they've got a pathologist, Glenn Larkin, who said that it could have been within 2 hours of discovery of the body, perhaps at dusk. But let's look at what also he says in his report. He says there is not enough data to form an estimate of the time of Mr. Bailey's death. An estimated time of Duran Bailey's death is tenuous at best because of a lack of data with which to work. Tenuous. Is that what we're going to say is evidence of actual innocence, that we're going to cause a new trial now because of some tenuous estimation based on some entomology experts who come in and based on the bugs, insects on the body, the lack thereof, that the death had to have occurred after sunset, which was at 8:01. Well, Dr. Sims, one of his ranges was up to 7:50 p.m. at night as a possible range of the death occurring. So we're off by maybe 10 minutes. They alibied her for that entire time frame. There's no alibi there for that 10 minutes that didn't already exist at trial and that wasn't already testified to and rejected by the jury.
Mr. Owen,
yes.
Is this actual innocence claim a freestanding or gateway claim, and should this court consider a freestanding gateway, or excuse me, a freestanding actual innocence claim on post-conviction?
I struggled with this quite a bit because I wasn't sure what kind of claim that they were making. I would say that a freestanding actual innocence claim in habeas is not cognizable in Nevada. I think that's where they're going with this. I don't think that it's a gateway claim because their petition is not procedurally barred, but yet they rely on many of the cases that come up with this standard of review for gateway innocence claims. We also have our statute for motions for new trial based on newly discovered evidence that must be brought within 2 years. To me, it appears they don't want to go under that statute because then they're limited by that two-year time bar that they missed, but it seems like this is nothing more than an untimely motion for new trial. All of this evidence could have been discovered by them or was actually known to them within that two-year time frame. So we have to balance...
Mr. Owens, if the court were to view this as a freestanding actual innocence claim, why shouldn't we or what evaluation should the court give to consideration of freestanding claims, actual innocence claims in post-conviction or not?
This court should take its lead from the U.S. Supreme Court, which in the Herrera case said that hypothetically there might be some sort of constitutional freestanding actual innocence claim. But historically, habeas is to correct errors of law, not errors of fact. And exactly that's what this court said in the Osborne case in 1966 that opposing counsel relies upon. I don't know anyone here in Nevada that's tried to cite Osborne as some sort of freestanding actual innocence recognition by this court. U.S. Supreme Court said, we don't know what the standard is. It's going to be extraordinarily high. All we know is that this defendant hasn't met it, nor has any other case that's ever come before the U.S. Supreme Court. They've stayed away from that. They've left it hypothetically open. I suggest that's a good answer for this court. Potentially, it might be available. The type of evidence, you know, I think you'd have to use not the Schlupp standard, you'd have to use the combination of the Sawyer standard, clear and convincing evidence. You'd have to take these seven or eight factors that we have for motions for new trial that has to be newly discovered, not merely impeachment evidence, has to be material to the defense. There's seven or eight of those. You've got to take and combine those along with something else, because otherwise the motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence will simply go away. Who would want to go under a stricter statutory standard when they have a looser, easier constitutional standard?
If we rejected a freestanding actual innocence claim, would that preclude review of, say, for example, DNA evidence that exculpates a defendant from a crime brought on a even, well, let's stick with a timely filed post-conviction petition?
No, the legislature has already looked at this. This is across the country. States are taking interest in this, and that's where I think the solution, the remedy lies, is with the legislature. They cited the Hamilton, New York case. They claimed that was in habeas. My notes from reading it, there's a lot of material here. My notes, I wrote down, that was not a habeas case. That was a statutory remedy in Hamilton. We have here a couple statutory remedies that Ms. Lobato could avail herself of. One is the motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence, and the other is the motion for DNA testing, which has an exception which waives that two-year bar for motions for new trial. The legislature is looking at this. If they want to create some sort of extra remedy, that's where it lies. I don't think in habeas it's appropriate to go opening up something. What is the standard going to be? The day this court creates a freestanding or recognizes a freestanding actual innocence claims, the day every single inmate in prison lines up and files another petition trying to meet that amorphous standard. And we have trouble applying the gateway innocence standard. No, what exactly is enough for the gateway claim? Certainly, freestanding innocence has to be something higher than that.
Well, my understanding of the actual innocence really goes to only death penalty cases where you have invalid aggravating circumstances, and then it's actual innocence of death. That's where I've seen it. So this is new to me as far as a freestanding claim of actual innocence. So I think there's other ways. I think the DNA example is one of newly discovered evidence to get somebody out. I mean, that's the way I would do it if I was a defense attorney.
Right.
And actually, the DA usually agrees if the DNA is the suspect as to a different a defendant. They've been pretty cooperative throughout the country that I know of. I've even been to a seminar where a guy had 22 years in prison in Maryland, and the only one who believed in him was his mother until the DNA cleared him, and the state went along with it. So that's my feeling.
Let me get back to some of this forensic evidence, because it also ties into these claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. Notably, I found in the record where trial counsel David Sheik and the defense team did have a medical examiner specifically on the issue of time of death. They didn't call the witness, but it was Charles Wetley, a medical examiner. The site for the court and opposing counsel is volume 3 of the appendix at page 612. In there you'll find a statement to the court. You'll find a statement to the court that Charles Wetley's estimation of the time of death was consistent with that of Dr. Sims. It was based on a medical examiner, rigor mortis, and lividity of the body. Certainly it was not based on the entomology experts that they've got now, but we're talking about a 10-minute window. It simply wouldn't have made a difference. At trial, we agreed and said nothing at this crime scene ties Lobato to it forensically. And so additional forensic testimony trying to exclude her from the crime scene is never going to amount to an actual innocence claim. Show me another black man with a missing penis, and maybe we'll have something to talk about in terms of maybe this confession was to some other incident. But nothing at the crime scene is going to help them, because the jury already knew the evidence there pointed away from Kirsten.
Do you want us to establish a bright line rule on evidentiary hearings for ineffective assistance of counsel? Because it goes, you know, it tends on the discretion of the district judge as to whether they have evidentiary hearings.
Well, they have a standard. It's facts not belied by the record, which would show the defendant's entitled to relief, not bare claims. The Brady claim that they mentioned is a bare claim. They've got a piece of paper supposedly found in the victim's pocket with 9 phone numbers. They got an affidavit from this Hans Scherer character, whose name appears in here sporadically for doing various types of investigation after the trial. And he says one of those numbers that has the letter D next to it is to a police officer. That's a bare claim. It doesn't explain how he thinks it's a phone number of a police officer. Why? Did he pick up the phone and call 8 years after the fact? If that's how he got it, are we sure that the phone number and what it goes to 8 years after the fact is what it went to in 2001? And even if it was a police officer's phone number, how is that exculpatory? They don't make out anything other than a bare allegation. They don't develop that claim and explain how or why something was withheld from them. The phone numbers certainly weren't withheld, and they could have called the number at any time. They have or done some investigation, and they have no proof that we somehow knew it belonged to a police officer, and I've never seen any evidence that it does belong to a police officer.
But is mere argument enough to credit or discredit claims of Brady claim or ineffective assistance counsel claim without having actual testimony under oath? Just attorneys arguing?
They've got to give us specific facts, not just bare allegations to buy themselves an evidentiary hearing. Anyone can make some sort of bald allegation and say, now I get an evidentiary hearing, and then they want to use the evidentiary hearing as a discovery tool to develop their claim. They need to come forward and make their allegation and give, in effect, an offer of proof in the facts. That's what our case law holds out. There needs to be specific facts, not belied by the record, showing entitlement to relief. And they haven't done that. It just came up with this bare allegation of a Brady claim.
Now, that might be the case, but in this particular case, do you think the judge's findings of fact were sufficient?
No, absolutely. I saw no need to have yet another. Remember, we got a first trial, and we got a second trial, and we got witnesses with 3-4 versions. We're going to get a fifth and sixth version, and the more time that this goes on, the further we get from the truth, which is why the legislature said new trial motions need to be brought within 2 years. Because if we're going to really find something significant that exonerates somebody, it's likely going to come sooner rather than later. And so at this stage of the game, can you imagine what a circus and evidentiary hearing would be on this case? How are you going to narrow the issues enough? We're going to have a retrial of this, and we're going to have so many levels of impeachment and wade through this all again. There's enough facts in the record where we can utilize the presumption of counsel's competence, and this was David Sheik, Chief of the Special Public Defender's Unit, Sherry Greenberger, who's supposed to have some expertise. She came over from California, expertise in wrongful convictions, and another attorney. There was 3 of them. They called upwards of 12 alibi witnesses, 3 expert witnesses. They had the everything from the first trial. They did their best. And the jury, this is a case that comes down to the facts, and the jury listened to this stuff. This new evidence they want to put on is not new. These witnesses have been known. They've been around. It's cumulative to what the jury already rejected at trial. To what end would we be putting those same facts before a judge and having a judge decide whether or not the jury was correct in the way it weighed these facts? Our justice system is dependent upon jury verdicts. Claims of actual innocence, if not narrowly tailored and held to the very high standard that they're supposed to be, seek to undermine that principle of a jury is the one who decides what really happened, what facts are true and what are not.
Mr. Rollins, I think your time's up. Then, Justice Douglas.
I'd like to ask one question. I understand his time is up. As to the Brady allegation that's been raised, as to activities of the investigating detective, in terms of what he investigated as to the woman in the apartment near the dumpster and the 3 individuals, Mexicans, who were also there, and statements about whether he investigated or didn't investigate these people, and whether that would undermine his credibility, and should a hearing have been given or not as to those allegations.
He testified at trial about those allegations. He was asked repeatedly about what investigation he did or the lack thereof and the lack of documenting it. They impeached him with his claims that he had investigated these Hispanics and what he had done to try to find out if they had any connection to this. The jury heard those facts. There's nothing new here that they're offering. Some sort of false Social Security number, I think, is what they've come up with, that they think the detective could have been impeached with. Well, there was no evidence at trial that he used a Social Security number to investigate them, that he may have had a date of birth or a name or something. The record simply doesn't show. But they want to suggest that because there was a false social, and there was testimony that these were probably illegal aliens, these Hispanics. It would not be unusual for them to have a false social. Where does that get us? The jury heard that. What further are we going to establish in terms of ineffectiveness of counsel? They haven't been able to come forward and do anything with that false Social Security number that would have changed the outcome of the trial. So I see no reason for an evidentiary hearing on that point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have 2 minutes there in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I first wanted to respond to the Justice's question beforehand. I might have misinterpreted it. In regards to the need to have the pathologist's information be heard in front of an evidentiary hearing in regards to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, is that when we look at the responsibility of the defense attorney or attorney, a team of attorneys, in this case, the crucial piece of the puzzle, which I disagree with the state's argument, is time of death. And it's not a mere 10 minutes. I'm looking at least about 10 hours. The state's argument from trial, they have placed, they say Ms. Lobato could not have been in Las Vegas any later than 7 a.m., right? Our expert witnesses post-trial have said that the time of death was approximately 8 p.m., right? Approximately almost 12-hour window in regards to 8 p.m. versus 7 a.m. And the belief is that the victim here, Mr. Bailey, died between 3:50 a.m. and possibly 7 a.m. If that is true, which we believe it is, there could not have been a time period for Ms. Lobato to leave Las Vegas and return to Panaca, which she was verifiably stated to be in Panaca by 11:30 at the latest. This is also the state's evidence as well. In regards to, I know my time is very short here, in regards to some of the statements that the state has mentioned, I think it's crucial to point out that DNA, I just want to point out that we have asked that the DNA be tested on numerous occasions in this case. The state has refused to test it. We would love to have the DNA be tested. As Your Honor has mentioned, that throughout the country, there's been a movement to test DNA, and that DNA has exonerated numerous defendants. And there's been DAs throughout the country who have said that we want to make sure that the correct person is behind bars. That's what we want as well. We believe and trust, we trust the scientific evidence. We are willing to put our client's freedom at risk there to test it.
Also, as the DNA argument, I mean, we have a situation where the state's conceding that there was not.
Was not DNA?
As to Lobato. So, well, where does that take us then?
Well, we are saying the opposite. We're saying there was DNA. We're saying there was DNA on the scene that, if tested, could rule out Ms. Lobato's presence at the scene.
So we're saying, again, we're pointing to the another unnamed assailant.
Potentially, correct. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much, counsel, both counsel, and we appreciate your excellent arguments and briefs in this case, and we will take this case under submission.